Hi there, welcome along to this week's High Performance Podcast. As always, it makes a huge difference to us if you can rate and review the podcast. It helps us to reach new people. And for Damien and I, this podcast is all about creating an impact with people. So if you can leave a review, if you can rate the pod, it will help us impact them. So thank you so much for doing that in advance. And this week's episode is so interesting. I'm not sure we've had a conversation like it. Here's the kind of stuff you're going to hear.
Yeah, obviously you're the bastard, isn't you? Because you know you're letting people go, or they'd let themselves go. I was honest with everybody, saying I want to keep pushing it as far as we can push it. And you know, I was very, very ambitious and driven at that point. And whoever didn't want to jump on board, really, that was it.
So there's so much awaiting you in this week's episode. Just a quick reminder, you can also find the High Performance Podcast on YouTube. Just search for High Performance Podcast. Millions and millions of views on our YouTube channel. I think it really does make a difference when you can see what people are talking about as well as hear them. But it's time for this week's episode. I really hope you enjoy it. Damien and I got so much from this conversation with a man we have great respect for. It's time for this week's High Performance Podcast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless, when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month, when you purchase a 3-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Hi there, I'm Jake Humphrey and you're listening to High Performance, the podcast that delves into the minds of some of the most successful athletes, visionaries, entrepreneurs and artists on the planet, and aims to unlock the very secrets to their success. As always, Damien Hughes is alongside me. And Damien, we've always been clear with people that this is not a sports podcast. This is a podcast about life. And people in all walks of life still need a high-performance mindset to succeed. And I think we're going to hear a lot about that today.
Very much, Jake. I think what we're in the business of is talking about people, regardless of the industry that they're in, and looking to strive for high performance. And the thing I'm really fascinated about today's guest is the role of vulnerability in high performance, willing to put yourself out there on the edge and to be judged. And I think that's going to be a really fascinating topic today.
Right, let's do it then. Let's understand a bit more about a man who is the epitome of a family saying that my parents instilled in all of their kids, which is roots and wings. My mum and dad repeated that to us on a daily basis. The wings were ours to fly with and go and do amazing things, but the roots were always there to keep us grounded. And I get the sense that today's guest was also given both by his parents. His wings have allowed him to form a band that sold millions of albums, topped charts and toured the world. Yet the roots mean He still seems so closely connected to the family and friends from the small coal mining village where he was brought up. So what has he learned from his high performance life of roots and wings that you can learn from? Welcome to the podcast, Kelly Jones.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, yeah.
What is high performance in your mind?
I guess a lot of it comes down to discipline, really. When I was around about 9, 10, 11, my dad took me to a boxing club and my uncle was a referee and they lied about my age so I could start fighting. So I was doing like 5 fights a season and there was an old trainer guy called Ray and another one called Gwilym. And I can still hear those guys' voices in my head like today, which is like 35 years ago, you know. So there's something instilled in me, I think, in that period of time where the kind of work you put in equals the kind of result you get out. So to me, I guess the high performance thing is the graft and the discipline, which is a kind of a weird thing to put into rock and roll because you're meant to be not disciplined and supposed to be very reckless. So it's an internal battle that you have to have with yourself sometimes. But yeah, it comes down to it, I think, to sustainability anyway.
I think that's really fascinating observation, Kelly. I think that I'm a real advocate of the book, The War of Art. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard it, where the author in that talks about amateurs wait for inspiration, professionals just show up and do the work.
Yeah, it's the preparation. You know, you can walk into a situation which people can seemingly think it looks easy, but the prep that you put into that position is a lot. And especially, I think, in the last, I would say 5, 6, 7 years maybe, the amount of preparation I do now before I walk out is, I would say, 50 times more than what I was doing in the 90s. You know, the 90s, I would, you know, sing an Otis Redding song backstage, have a swig of vodka and walk on stage. And that was
Sounds
it.
Sounds good
and
to
that
be
was,
fair.
And it was great, you know.
It's a good night out.
But it was like, I was playing for 45 minutes, 50 yeah. minutes. I had one album and then you get 2 albums, then you get 11 albums and then you're playing for 2.5 hours a night and the rooms are bigger and bigger and bigger and you're doing 6 arenas in 7 days. So the recovery time is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, but the expectancy is getting larger and larger and larger and larger. So if you don't learn some tricks and preparation and tools to maintain the ability, then, you know, you're going to let people down and you're going to let yourself down and all that kind of stuff. So it always comes back to discipline, really.
So what are your tricks that you've learned?
A bit like Clint Eastwood said in Dirty Harry, a man needs to know his limits, really. And you go through many periods in your life where you mess up and you're chasing your tail. And I've done stuff. I've been up till 5 o'clock in the morning and then I had to drink water for about 8 hours leading up to a show and then gone on. I've cancelled 2 shows in 25 years. So I've got a pretty good record of being able to still deliver. But some nights, you know, you've burnt the candle way too far on the other end and you learn how far you can go with that the next time, you know?
It sounds to me like the Matthew McConaughey tip, which he gave us on this podcast of don't leave crumbs. He said, if you leave crumbs, you've got to go back and pick them up eventually.
Well, that's it. And there's nowhere in the world worse to be than on a stage singing songs that people want to sing back to you. And if you can't sing them. So I never really wanted to be in that position. So I've been in some really tricky ones, but I've managed to crawl away from them. Yeah.
Can I ask you about your dad? Because he fascinated me when I was doing the research on this, that he grew up in the same town of Cwmbran. And he got out, he sort of became a successful recording artist himself.
Yeah.
And then gave it up to come back and look after the family.
He did. My dad was, when I grew up, my old man's record was on the jukebox in the pub, which is a very strange thing, really. So
what emotion did that give you?
Well, I was allowed in the pub at a very young age because of my old man. I was always classed as Oscar's boy, you know, so I had a free backstage pass to the pub and the snooker room upstairs sort of thing. So, but my two older brothers were always babysitting for me. So they were always playing music and stuff and they would take me around the workmen's clubs to watch my old man sing. So I'd be sitting there with my mother watching him. So I learned a lot from I guess, watching how you construct set lists and how you can walk onto you play workmen's clubs, man, there's people with their feet up on the front of the stage reading the South Wales Echo. They couldn't care less, you know. So you had to win them over. So you could walk on and they don't care. And then bit by bit, as I watched him, he would slowly drag them in, drag them in, drag them in. And by the end, it was a standing ovation and everybody was on the chairs. And I was always like, how did you do that? You know, it's quite an art in itself to win an audience over. And that's through song selection, that's through pacing, and that's through knowing an audience. You know, I've always, even if you're in a house party, if somebody puts the wrong music on, you can kill a house party just in your kitchen. You know, if you don't know who's in your room and what kind of people they are, you can soon lose them. I think knowing people workingmen's clubs, working in a market, once you get an understanding of human beings, I think you've got a much more better understanding of what your songs can mean to people as well.
So when you're on stage, and we've both just recently watched your new documentary, Don't Let the Devil Take Another Day.
Yeah.
There are numerous shots in that brilliant documentary, and I'd tell anyone to go and find it and watch it. It's so interesting. Numerous shots of you getting standing ovation, standing on the stage, taking a bow. How much of when people come and watch you now performing, are you using tricks and perhaps even inspiration and lessons that you picked up from those early days?
A lot, really, I suppose, back in the day. But the only thing that's different is I wrote all of the set list, whereas my dad was doing cover versions and stuff. So for me, that whole tour came as an idea during a very challenging time after having the throat surgery. And I didn't realize until this week, really, the whole concept of the tour was to pick the songs in my career that were about adversity and overcoming challenging times in my life, whether it was Maybe Tomorrow or Into the World, and all these songs that never really get played that much in stereophonic shows. So it was an opportunity to kind of sandwich them together with very humorous stories about kind of traumatic, tragic events in my life. But hindsight always offers humor, because at the time they're not very funny at all. So you get this show of, you know, you make them laugh, you make them cry, you make them wait, kind of thing. And so, going through art college, learning some stuff from there, stealing some stuff from my dad, doing some stuff myself, did my first gig at 12 in a workingman's club myself. So I think that's why a lot of the big legends, whether it's the Who, Bowie, the Stones, they all took us under their wing, because I think we were kind of the last generation of bands that did the same as them, which was in the back of a van going through pubs and clubs. Because after that, it became people getting discovered on TV and all that kind of stuff, you know.
We should probably talk then about the throat moment, shouldn't we? And yeah, the subsequent surgery and then the tour. For people that don't know, late 2018, a polyp. Was it a polyp discovered on your vocal cords?
Yeah. I went for just a regular checkup, and they found, they called it a one-off trauma polyp on my vocal cords, which could have been done by a bad cough or shouting at the football or... And I was trying to trace back my steps, and there was this one day I was going to the gym, and I'd been trying to get to the gym like all week because, you know, a lot of kids in the house and all stuff going on. And I eventually got out the door and I was driving there. And as I got to the gym, I remembered I left my keys in the front door, and I let out this massive fuck. and I always remember it kind of hurting a bit. So I don't know if that was the moment. So the moral there is don't leave your keys in the door and all that. But, I went and had the check, and they said they found this thing, and then they said, go away, come back in a couple of weeks. And then I went back a couple of weeks and they're still there. They said, come back in a couple of weeks. And then ended up going back in on New Year's Eve for the last check. And they said, it's still there. I think we're going to have to operate. So they said, come back in on, I think it was January the 7th. And I went in and they took it off. And then I had to go to Wales for a recovery thing. I couldn't speak for about 3 days. And then I could speak for 2 minutes, and then I could speak for 5 minutes. So I was just reading like a chapter out of a book out loud and then stopped talking. And so it was quite a strange process. And then it was about learning how to literally how to sing again. And I've never had a vocal coach before. So I contacted this guy who Declan, the surgeon, put me in touch with, Joshua. And he would teach me these things about blowing into straws and stuff like that first. So you strengthen the muscle without straining it, which is quite bizarre, because it looked like a bunch of drugs, really, with straws and bottles and pipes everywhere. So if anybody walked in my room, they probably thought I was having a good time in there. So I just had to go through all this very, very slow process, really, and try to and regain the strength in the thing that's kind of given me my whole kind of life, really.
That, to me, was a very vulnerable time. As Jake said, watching the film, I was really struck by the vulnerability that you were exposed to. But vulnerability is a common theme throughout your whole history, Kelly. So whether it's that I've read the quote that you never wanted to be famous. So to become a frontman and start singing exposed you to vulnerability. And, you know, having to lose bandmates on the journey has made you vulnerable, and releasing albums where you'd be told you weren't going to sell.
Yeah.
You seem to be comfortable with that discomfort that a lot of people would shy away from. So what can you tell us, for anyone listening, about how to be comfortable with being vulnerable?
I think I've walked towards it a lot in my life, as much as I've tried to walk away from it. When I look at the content in the songs, that a lot of the big songs that people connect to have come from some of the most vulnerable times in my life, really. And putting that out there is vulnerable. The whole film was... is a vulnerable idea to expose that this has happened. I kind of kept it secret because I needed to get a lot of these things under my belt, whether it was the albums finished, the number one record, a successful
tour. Is that why you
tour.
Didn't tell anyone?
Yeah.
Because watching it, I thought, why not tell these people you trust and work with? You know, we've got your manager, Natalie, who came here today.
Mm. She knew.
But 25 years you've worked together, so yeah. I'm not surprised. But there are still people on there that you're really close with and you didn't tell them.
No, the band in the film don't know. I still haven't told them. And it wasn't like, oh, let's keep this secret. It was much more about, like, if you're a ballet dancer and you broke your ankle and then you go out there and people are watching you after a break, they're going to go, it's not quite as good. You know, you see it in football all the time. Somebody's had an injury. They're judging them before they've even had a crack. I needed to get to the end of something and have appreciation for whatever the job I've done, neutral, and say, that was great. You sound better than ever or whatever. And I needed to know that myself more so. And then I was just talking about it and Ben overheard it. And Ben's like, you know, I think that should be part of the story of 2019. And I'm like, I'm not sure. He said, have you got footage of it? And I said, I've got all these videos. I've got millions of videos because I had to send them to the vocal coach. And he pieced it together in a way where, you know, the story had a great arc from beginning, middle to end, which is about overcoming adversity and offering hope, really, which a lot of my songwriting is that, you know, maybe tomorrow I'll find my way home. There's always a kind of searching for something, but then offering, you know, there is a light at the end of the tunnel sort of thing. I think when you become honest and vulnerable, I think people actually, it's a bit like if you close your heart, then you don't really let it out. You know what I mean? You don't let out whatever you're trying to give. And I think from the late 90s, when people started to have a dig at us, because they praise you up and then they start giving you a dig. And then I wrote a song, Mr. Writer, about a journalist. And then they thought I was writing about every journalist. So then they all turned on me. When I was walking into interviews, I was doing 12 interviews a day, every day. I mean, we were the most successful band in the country. We were headlining Glastonbury, we were headlining Vs, Lancaster, all in the same year. He was huge in 2002, 2003. But I was doing all these interviews and the first question they would say to me, so are you 8 journalists? And I'd be like, so your back's up and your armor comes on. And then you start showing a version of yourself, which is not the placid kind of Kelly kid that went to art college and just loved being in a band. It was a bit more like, you know, are you on a pop, mate? And so you're always on your guard. So you're always kind of defending yourself. And you kind of get a little bit, I don't know, are you on a pop? Are you trying to come at me? So it becomes a bit confusing. And then bit by bit by bit, you start peeling off. And it came to the last few years where I just felt like I wanted to show more of the personality that I know that I am in and amongst my family and my kids and the bandmates and everybody that I know, because I've been very, very private. And the solo tour was a way of doing that. I just going up there and telling stories about what's going on in my life, and people liked it. And
so how much did it bother you then that people had a certain idea of what and who Kelly Jones was because of a couple of comments or a sharp tongue in the odd interview or whatever? But you were young as well.
Yeah, I was young, yeah. And I haven't really thought about it, to be honest. It bothered me in around about 2001, 2002, I haven't really given him much attention in my life ever. I'm not losing sleep over it, but around about just enough education to perform when it was quite intense then. I was the first time I moved to London after breaking up with my girlfriend from back home. So it was all kind of happening at the same time. So it's a bit like a whirlwind at that point because you don't quite know who you are, what people want from you, which version of you do they like, which version of you are you supposed to be. And it was the time where the newspapers was all about slagging everybody off. We'd slag a band off, they'd slag us off. And it was a very laddish kind of period of time. And to be fair, I'm not really that laddish in that way. I've been brought up with 3 brothers, but it's like, we're all good drinkers and all the rest of it, but it's not really about that kind of banter really. We give as good as we get, but you start becoming a version of yourself that you're not really.
I read about you, Kelly, that you don't read any interviews about yourself that you famously don't go on social media or anything like that. You shy away from it. What benefits do you think come from liberating yourself from that?
Well, when I began, I never, you know, all my mates, when they started bands, they all used to read The Enemy and The Melody Maker and all these newspapers. But I never did. You know, I loved my brother's record collection where there's Neil Young, Bob Dylan. I loved AC/DC and my dad sold records and stuff like that. So I would be taking my inspiration from music, whether it was the Kinks, Creedence, Clearwater Revival, songwriters. So when somebody offered me a record deal and I went out there, the process of the actual doing of it was kind of enough for me. So when it comes to the social media side of things now, I feel like the benefit really is I never really did it for anybody else's opinion, really. I did it for my release, what I wanted to get from it. And I don't really need to read through you know, thousands and thousands of likes and opinions just to see what somebody else will say. Because as we all know in this world now, 9 times out of 10, there could be 99 amazing comments, but the one that says, you know, your crap is the one that you take to bed that night. So I just didn't think it was beneficial really for what I needed from it.
Can we talk about when you mentioned the release, writing the music? There's a lot of conversations at the moment about people talking and, you know, three men sitting around a table like this, having a conversation about your emotions as the leader of a band is not the sort of interview you'd have been having probably even 5 years ago, right?
No.
So let's get into what the music does for you psychologically.
It's interesting because I think in the last few years, I realized that I thought writing a song about something I went through was me dealing with it and it was done. Because it's quick and it gets out there and it's honest. I don't know where it came from. One minute it's there and the next minute, one minute's not there, then the next minute it's on a page. And then it kind of informs you back, going, oh, was I feeling that? Right, I'm feeling that because it's coming from my subconscious. Because I don't write lyrics like homework like a lot of people. A lot of my contemporaries, they think the lyric part is just like, oh, let's get a rhyming dictionary out. And what does this? And that's not the way I do it. If it don't come, it don't come. And I would just... If you look through my lyric books, there's not a lot of scribbling out. It lands on the page and that's what it is. So it's a catharsis, so it's definitely something that comes through you. But I've realized, I think the pace of my life over the last 25 years has been moving so fast that a lot of that stuff may have been dealt with on a very, very small percentage.
You've just scratched the surface, maybe.
Yeah. And then as you get more time to slow down, a bit more time to reflect, or other things keep coming up and the issues or whatever, they keep coming up, you realize, well, you haven't really dealt with that. There's other stuff going on under there and then you start delving into it a bit more. So it's definitely got an outlet. It's definitely got a process, a bit like a painter throwing paint on a canvas or you're writing a journal or whatever it is really. But whether it's the full expression, the full outlet, the full let's get it all out of your system, I don't know. I don't think it's the full thing, no.
Do you go back and look at those things and... now as an older and wiser Kelly Jones, make sure that you do deal with them? Or do you think you still haven't quite got to that point?
It's fear, isn't it? Again, it comes back to the vulnerability. We're all scared of stuff. We're all terrified of being hurt. We're all, whatever it's wrapped up in, you can pick a million issues, but it all comes back to the same basis really, which is fear. And I think the older you get, the realize you can't brush it under the carpet. You have to kind of walk at it. In a way, you've almost got to run towards it because otherwise it's going to eat you up really. So... and it's horrible. But if you don't do it, I think it just comes back around and it comes back around and it comes back around, really. So it's about peeling off the layers slowly. It's a very odd job because it's a very weirdly lonely job a lot of the time because you're spending so much time when you go back to the discipline. You arrive in a town about 9 a.m, you got a sound check of 4, then you probably got press between 4 and 7 or something. And then you warm up and then you walk on stage at 8:30 till 11. And then you're back in the front of 50,000 people, then you're back on a bus. And, you can have a good time and all that after the show, but it kind of goes round. So that all that time leading up to the show, if you're not reserving energy, by the time you walk on, you haven't got the full tank of what you need to be delivering. So it's not like you can walk around the town and have a great time in the start. Yeah, it's a weird kind of balancing act, really.
And there's not three lead singers in the band, is there?
No.
It's all on you.
So there's a lot of pressure, and I've related it, the last 10 years, I've related it a lot to the sports thing. That's what I said to you earlier when I listened to the Johnny Wilkinson thing. A lot of that rang true to what I do for a living, and you're waiting for that moment where you actually feel it, where you feel like you're in the flow, because it's very hard to find the flow. It's very hard to become present in that thing because there's so many things going on at the same time. There's so many moving parts. So to find it, you have to completely let go and release, and you catch yourself sometimes going, where did I go? And it's amazing. And then you come back to thinking about other stuff,
What does intrigue me though about your world, Kelly, is that the way you've just described that preparation for a show and things like that is that you must be surrounded by lots of people that just want to tell you how amazing you are and tell you how fantastic it was and how it touches you. So when you talk about that vulnerability and feeling open enough to express yourself properly, how do you find or recruit people in your inner circle that you can be honest with and they can be honest with you?
In the beginning, it was all mates and brothers. We took everybody from the village. The first time a tour bus pulled up outside my house, it's a one-way street. It's got a bus stop at the end and this big tour bus pulled up outside and my brother walked out the house, my brother Lee, and he looked at it and he walked across the street. He saw there was bunk beds. He saw there was bottles of vodka in the fridge. There was beer everywhere. He said, where are you going? I said, Scandinavia. He said, fuck this, I'm getting my bag. And he walked back across the house and he grabbed his bag and he came on the trip with us. So,
how proud were you at that moment though?
Oh man, it was like the Queen coming to town. Everybody was out the curtains. It was ridiculous.
That's incredible.
But it was, so we took as many mates as we could and it lasted for, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years. And then, you know, it was like a bender really. It was like a rugby tour and the gig just happened to get in the way of the good time. And after a while, I think it got to Live 8. And when we did Live 8, we had a phone call. It was in Australia and Bob Geldof was organizing the show. We had a call saying, would you do it? And we said, yeah, we got to fly back. And then we had to fly to Australia. It was a mental 3 days. But they said, each act is a 7-minute changeover. And we thought, no, we can't do it. So we can't do it. And then me and Richard sat in the two of us and thought, well, we can do it. It's the crew that can't do it because they're all our mates and they're all pissed or they're all, you know, they're not prepped up. They can't do it. So that's when we realized that we've gone to one level, but the boys from back home are just still thinking we're playing in the boozer. And we were just about to turn down the biggest gig in the world because we couldn't do a 7-minute changeover, which is not actually our job. So then you start getting a bit more professional. You start trying to find people who, you know, when we toured with you two, I remember we were talking to The Edge and he said, if I want to be the best guitar player in the world, then I want my tech to be the best tech in the world. And when you're touring with U2 and you're touring with Bowie, you're touring with Rolling Stones, you start seeing all these different levels of people and you start seeing how comfortable the artists are on stage because all they have to do is concentrate on their job, not worrying about everybody else's job. Then you start thinking, well, maybe we should take a bit of this on board, really.
And how was that, though? Because that must have been difficult that you then got the accusations that you've sold out or...
You've changed.
Yeah, you've changed.
Yeah, obviously you're the bastard, didn't you? Because you know, you're letting people go or they'd let themselves go. You're offering them, you know, opportunities to go and learn in this kind of capacity, go to Gibson, get some training, you know, whatever it might be. But people don't often take you up on stuff like that. They just think you can carry on, but it's just growth again. It comes back to the growth. And I was honest with everybody saying, I want to keep pushing it as far as we can push it. And, you know, I was very, very ambitious and driven at that point. And whoever didn't want to jump on board, really, that was it.
The challenge, I suppose, also is remembering the lessons that you learn from those periods.
Yeah.
You know, the press loved making a big thing, didn't they, when your former bandmate Stuart passed away. Oh, you weren't getting on. Do you have regrets now?
Mm.
You were getting on. You'd had a period where you weren't, then you were.
Yeah.
But you still... To have a childhood friend who you have to ask to leave the band, then they pass away. You, I'm sure, thought about that a great deal. I wonder whether you've worked hard to keep hold of those lessons that you've learned and if you have, how you've managed to do it. Because I think we all say, oh, that's changed my life, that. And 2 years later, we've forgotten how and why.
It can do that. The Stuart thing was interesting because, again, we were very private. We knew what was going on with Stuart in his life and we knew he was getting a bit... you know, off track really. And, you know, we've all went through it and we all picked each other up at times when we had, but Stuart was going on this road where it didn't look like any of us could pull him back from it. And we had to let him go. And it wasn't like getting rid of a band member. As you know, in the film, I lived 6 doors apart from Stuart my whole life, you know, so it's like, I've been in a band with him since I was 12. The first gig I did at 12, he was 15, you know, so that's how long I'd been with him. So when we parted ways, you know, we didn't talk for like a year or whatever. And then the press were giving me the outing about it, because I'd fired Stuart, because I wouldn't tell the press what Stuart was getting up to in his private life, basically, because it's his business. But then, of course, when Dakota goes to number one, which is the next single after Stuart has left, the first single we ever had go to number one, which I wrote and produced it, the first text I get is off Stuart saying, congratulations, man, what a fucking great song, basically. And then the review in Q magazine, I always remember, was the first line said, Stuart who? So it was like they'd given me the outing, but then when the song comes out, then it's like, well, you didn't really need him anyway.
And what?
Yeah. So so that's why I don't get involved in it really, because it's a bit like, well, what's the point? Because, you know, you're only taking one part of the story.
In many ways, I think it symbolizes what life has been like for you all the way through being in a band. It's a bit like being in an iceberg, right?
Yeah.
There's loads of stuff going on beneath the surface, whether it's traumas and setbacks and problems, personal or public. But all we see is the little bit of the iceberg above. And we base all our opinions on what someone like you is like privately on that little bit. And there's all that underneath. And I would not be able to deal with that. I just wonder how and whether you did. Whether you wanted to try and tell the whole story ever.
It's a difficult thing to articulate, really, because as you're going through it, you're obviously holding on to frustrations that people are not quite seeing the full picture. The first ever time I won a Brit Award, you know, my speech was, you know, about time for some recognition. It was the best newcomer award. And Ben Elton's like, you've only just got you. And I've been like, no, I've been, in my head, I'm going, I've been doing this for 13 years, mate. And it's about time somebody, but when you look back at it, you're kind of going, well, they don't know that.
Yeah.
You know, so you're obviously craving somebody to say, you know, you're doing a good job there, mate. And where that comes from, whether that's, you know, we need a kid, you wanted your old man to say something or whatever it is, you know, we've all got our reasons for it. But as you keep on going and people build, I guess, a perception through media, I always found it was more the media perception was kind of skewed compared to like when I go on the radio, people can hear who I am. Or if I go on the TV, they can, if I'm on Never Mind the Buzzcocks, they can see who I am. But when it became in print, it always came across like something else. And it used to frustrate us a lot, you know, and that's why we stopped reading it all, because we were like, we're not winning here. This is not coming across how we meant to be talking. So you do carry a bit of resentment through it all. And then I think I didn't realize I was doing it, but the last 3 years I was obviously doing stuff, making the record with Far From Saints, you know, the guys from Austin, Texas, doing the solo tour and doing the spoken word stuff. I've clearly started to show people other elements of my talent, personality, whatever you want to call it, even though I've been trying to do that through the brand of Stereophonics for 25 years by making every album completely different and trying to change the sound. I think I came to realization it doesn't matter what I do and change, it'll always be under the brand of Stereophonics, you know, whether it's Cocoa Pops or Corn Flakes, it's Kellogg's. So no matter how hard I try, it's still an amazing job, and there's 15-year-old kids coming to the gigs and there's people 60 coming to the
gigs. Listen, it's not a bad thing to be associated. Like,
it's an amazing,
this is Stereophonics,
it's an amazing thing, but I thought I was needing to walk away from it at one point because I couldn't work out. I'm not quite fulfilled what's going on because I want to do stuff. And then I realized, I think in the last few years, it's more about dividing that kind of pie chart up with, well, I can still do the Stereophonics, but like the Malcolm Gladwell thing, I don't need to put, you know, 100,000 hours into it now. It's there. But I can go over there and do this other project with these guys from Texas, or I can go over here and do this other thing, and I can grow and get fulfillment from these other projects, which will only ignite the main game.
See, but I think that's fascinating, Kelly, that even through the Stereophonics, that you've tried different sounds. You've been prepared to, like, strip it back. Then you've done, like the big anthemic stuff. How do you get the courage to almost let go of what might be a winning formula in one guise to try something completely different? Like, what's your driver of the processes that you put in place to reinvent yourself constantly?
Yeah, I mean, the first two records were, you know, of a typical thing. And then when we got to Just Enough Education, which became a really big record, I don't think there's many electric guitars on there at all, completely changed it. And then the album after that, with Maybe Tomorrow, you know, there was five of us on stage, three girl backing singers, there was Rugs. It almost became like, you know, the Grateful Dead for a bit, you know. And then we completely ripped that away and became three people again and come out with Dakota, which was all very linear, kind of hard edge, kind of almost like a garage stuff. So to me, it's about, well, you make these small choices like, well, I'm not going to do this in this record. I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that. I don't want to ever do that again. I want to try to do this. And it's about growth and trying to, you know, when I was a kid doing covers in pubs, I wasn't just doing Beatles and Stone Roses covers. I was doing everything from Bob Dylan to Bob Marley. It didn't make any difference to me. It was always about, if the song is good, it doesn't matter what genre it comes under. So I've never wanted to be boxed in with genre or anything like that. So they don't really feel like that big a risk to me. It's only when you put them back to back that they sound quite different from one another.
Is authenticity at the heart of that as well? Because if you look at the size and the scale at which you perform here in the UK compared to the States, right? Mm. You're not as big in the States as you are in the UK. You could have been bigger in the States if you'd have just forgotten about authenticity for a bit and thought, right, what do they want to hear? I don't know, I'll make a song that people will love on TikTok and then that'll drive my sales. Yeah. You could do that.
Yeah.
Is it a conscious decision not to?
I've been asked for many years to do many things, you know, whether it's publishers asking me to write songs for pop artists or, you know, every year asked to go on The Voice or The X Factor or all this kind of stuff. And it's all great, you know, TV and opportunities and fun stuff for people. But it's like, to me, I know I wouldn't be able to believe it. So these projects I'm talking about, whether it's the Far From Saints thing, that fell in my lap because I watched this girl singing 2013 and I loved her voice and I wanted to sing with her, and I knew that if we did something together it could be something quite unique. And to me, it's about trying to find an authenticity in, if you get into a collaboration, then it has to be for the right reason. I'd never wanted to be a factory kind of songwriter I could probably do that. Go to work every day and do a Ronnie Barker and write 5 songs a day and give them to people. But then they're not mine. It's like giving something away, you know?
So what would you say you are now? Because I think you're probably finally at an age where you actually can reflect, look back and be really honest about what you are as a singer-songwriter. Let's talk about legacy for a bit. In 50 years, what would you want people to say about your music?
I think going forward, I think for me now, it's a bit more about a portfolio in some ways. You know, I started in art school and I would have these big folders of all different things. I would be making films, I'd be making graphics, I'd be making fine art, I'd be doing all this different stuff. And I've always done all the artwork for the records and the t-shirts and stage design. I get involved in all that stuff because that's what my background is. I've directed the videos and I've written the videos and, you know, I've written some screenplays. I've nearly got a few films off the ground. So I think going forward, it's all going to come under the guise of storytelling, but the format that falls into, I don't think I'm going to put 100% of it just into the Stereophonics, because when we go back to fear and vulnerability, I've been afraid of walking sideways from the Stereophonics because I was afraid what would happen. And now I've actually got a belief that I don't have to be afraid of walking because I'm not walking away from it. I'm just taking a step to the side and doing this other bit and then I'll be right back. But I've been afraid to do that for probably 10, 15 years, you know. So allowing myself to do that, I think I've got scope to do many other things.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's show is brought to you in association with Mindlift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So Mindlift is neuroscience based. And what I love about Mindlift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out Mindlift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So Mindlift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text and data for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to the overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
I think bravery is such an interesting topic. I just want to touch on your son very briefly,
yep,
who came out as trans. And again, we're not after some salacious headline about, you know, yep, struggles with dealing with a child who's, you know, come out as trans or whatever. I'm just, there's two things about this, really. Number one, when you talk about bravery, you must have been so proud of your son to come out in the way that he did. Like, and he goes to an all-girls school, right?
Yep.
To walk in there every day takes, I mean, the bravery is something. I wonder what you've learned from him.
I've learned a lot from him. I've learned a lot for all my kids. I mean, I've just been walking around a park with my 13-year-old because she's going through stuff as well. And you can't stop learning from him, really. But, I mean, Colby's episode was, you got a young kid telling you something's not right and you think it's about the sexuality thing and it slowly trickles into the gender situation. And then I look around and I'm thinking, well, who can I talk to about this? I don't know one single person in all the people I know in my life that has ever been through this. I can talk to people about having kids from different mothers. I can talk to people about most things. Mm. But this is like, I've got no idea what's going on here. And once I realized that was actually happening, it was a case of I have to do my research and go and talk to some therapists to get help to get him therapist because he's at an age where you're not an adult, but you're not a child. And it's that in-between thing. So, but as you say, I mean, I went to watch a carol service at the school last summer and people are going, oh, it's just a phase. It'll be, you know, they'll grow out of it. And I went to this carol service and watched all these teenage girls singing with the long hair and the little spots and all the stuff they're doing. And then he walked down with like a short kind of cropped hair, like David Bowie or something, wearing trousers and a shirt. And he's like, I look like a bartender. And he couldn't have looked more different from the rest of the girls there. And I'm thinking, well, that takes a lot of balls there. And there's no way you would be doing that if it wasn't something for real, you know. So there's a lot of courage involved in that whole thing. Yeah, it's incredible, really.
I find that so moving because we live in a world now where being yourself is harder than ever before. Like, I think the three of us, you say you don't use social media. I know you don't go on Twitter because you hate it. The biggest source of stress in my life is the use of social media.
Right.
Now imagine what it's like for, how old is
16 now, yeah, 16. Just 16, yeah.
And do you use his social media?
I think they dip in and out of it from like putting art and stuff up there and Minecraft and stuff like that, but not to the extent where it's like masses of comments and stuff like that just yet. No.
But there will be judgment.
Yeah,
and for us to deal with judgment is hard and we're all in our 40s.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't believe there was no bullying at all.
Brilliant.
And if I compare that to where I came from, I mean, there wasn't any black people where I grew up. There were two gay people and literally, this no joking aside, they literally worked in the hairdressers. You know, it's that old cliche. So it's like, where I came from, there was, everybody had buried prejudices they didn't even know they had. So when these things become brought to life, you don't really realize what your omnipresent beliefs are, really. And then you have to face them. As I said earlier, by walking into them, you have to kind of go, right, well, it's courage, man. And at the end of the day, it's not me waking up every day feeling like that. It's Colby. All I am is a support network, really, and I have to just kind of guide him through it, you know.
We have a lot of parents that listen to this podcast, yeah, and a lot of our guests talk about things they've learned in their careers that they can apply as parents. What have you learned from that episode that's made you a better parent, do you think, that our listeners can pick up from?
I think, you know, I've got four kids, and each one of them have got their own story, really, from 16 to 6 months, and there's a lot of information you can keep giving them and there's a lot of information they can keep giving you and they can get all the statistics they want off YouTube and all the rest of it and you can try to reason them and all this. But at the end of the day, I think ultimately all a kid wants to know is that they're safe. And if you give them a hug and just tell them, look, it's going to be all right, man. And it might take a bit of time, but that's it. Because I think if you talk to them too much, I tried it this morning, it didn't work, but the hug worked.
Can we talk about hard work?
Yeah.
I think it's another area that people don't explore often enough or don't talk about often enough. How hard do you work?
I've been called a workaholic. I've been called many things. I suppose I push myself quite hard, yeah. But the problem is I don't feel like I am pushing myself that hard until my body starts going a bit crazy. I mean, in the last few months, I've had quite a lot of weird nervous system things happening to me, probably because my body has stopped after 20 odd years of going and going and going. I think my body was actually coming down to land, basically, and didn't know what was going on. But I do push myself quite hard in the sense of, I think that comes back to the fear thing again, is because I've been afraid of letting it go. So I'll come off tour and say, I'm not going to do anything. Within 6 weeks, I'm probably back in the studio with a bunch of songs and I'm calling everybody up going, I think we need to do this. And it goes very quick again. I think I work very hard as a father. I'm kind of a bit like a loaf of bread that's constantly being poked by all sides, really, in my house, because when I walk through the door, I feel like this lion has returned from the jungle and they all want to ask me something or do something, and I can't not give them all my time. And I don't know what that is, and it's become to a detriment of my own health and self to a point, because I haven't really learned how to delegate that very well. I haven't really learned how to ask for a lot of help a lot in my life. And I'm not one of having nannies running around the house or anything like that. I've always done it all. And Jackie, obviously. So I work really hard, I guess, is the true answer to it.
Could you have achieved what you have without that hard work?
No, I think tenacity and hard work, I think that comes from the working class background. I don't think you'd sustain in any industry without putting the preparation and the work in. It just doesn't last. I've looked around me and most of the people who have started with us are not there anymore. And it does come down to craft and it comes down to determination and ultimately hard work.
Some of your career is spent with like Tom Jones. You toured with Bowie in the early 2000s, Kelly. What advice did they pass on to you, like that generation above, about hard work and graft and learning your craft that you could share with our listeners?
I remember we did the tour with you two, and I remember Bono sitting on a table with me once, and he said, if you look around a table at some point in your life and more than 70% or something are on your payroll, then you probably become a prick. So every dinner I ever went on from that point on, I'd be like...
counting the people. Yeah, life advice from Bono, that's a whole different podcast, isn't it?
David Bowie, I guess what I learned from him was, I mean, watching that guy touring from one end of America to the other and craft, we talk about set list, the way he played the set list in the middle of America compared to how he played it on the West Coast and the East Coast was completely different. In the middle, it was all very, you know, let's dance and do what he needed to do. But then he became more left field everywhere he went. And he was, really? He was about knowing the audience. It was very interesting to see that.
Would you talk to him about that? Or do you think it was almost a subject? And what did he say?
He just knew his audience, really. Yeah. And, you know, I would write screenplays and I would give them to him and he would critique them and give me notes. Because it was the reality tour, I don't think he was playing any character. He was just being himself and he would come and sit on an icebox in the dressing room and just talk to you and ask you about your family and stuff like that. He was very grounded at that time. Like, we had a five-side football match and he was on the side of the pitch and heckling us. And when we lost, he brought the trophy down above our head on a piece of string and told the audience how crap we were at football.
I read a great story about him. Did he ever tell you about when he was doing his Ashes to Ashes and he was on Brighton Beach dressed as a clown?
Yeah, video, yeah.
And he talks about the story of a guy walked in shot and somebody said, do you not know who that is? And the bloke walking his dog and said, yeah, it's in a clown suit. And apparently he would sort of remind himself of that phrase. That was a phrase he would use to keep himself grounded and down to earth.
He was grounded. He was funny, man. He was... But yeah, I mean, what a privilege to have done that. He was obviously a legend. So I guess Tom Jones was about, what I learned from Tom is that how much he kind of loves life, really. You know, you'd land, you could be in Sweden or somewhere, Stockholm, landing 11 o'clock the night, everything's closed and stuff would open up for him. And he'd always have a good dinner. He'd always do the things that you should be doing in your life because he was always that relaxed. He didn't really have an artistic brain in the sense of overthinking anything. He's much more like, this is what I do, and then I'll go out my dinner. And it was much more old school.
Have you got to that point yet?
No.
Are you keen to get there?
I'm not sure as a writer I'd ever get there. I think because Tom is always, his voice is his thing and his personality, and because he was taking catalog from other people, he didn't have to go mining for the goods sort of thing. You know, when I go to work every day, there's nothing there. And I've got to come out of there with something. You know, it's not like your friend's working in the bank, but they're still dealing with other people's money. I've got to go and find my money, you know, and almost make it. It's a kind of weird headspace, you know.
But you're somebody that seems to be incredibly open to experiences, whether this was, like you say, when you started on the fruit and veg stall or when you were a kid growing up and you were observing your father on stage, and you're a storyteller by nature. I love that definition.
Mm.
So... how have you taken these stories of characters like Bowie, like Bono, like Tom Jones, and assimilated it into your own life? What is the one or two lessons you've taken that you have processed and that you still use?
The first time I ever met Tom was in a pub, and I remember sitting down with him, and he sat me and Stuart down for about 3.5 hours, and every single name we threw at him, from Morecambe and Wise to Frank Sinatra, he had an anecdote for. And I came away from that thinking, he could have had maybe 2 minutes with each one of those people. He could have had 2 weeks with each one of those people. It doesn't really matter. He had an experience with everybody, Elvis, Muhammad Ali, and he would tell me jokes about all these different people. So as you go through life, you realize, God, all these people you meet, you've got a tiny element of a story of all these people, and you can carry that and use that to, you know, whether you're on a dinner table or whatever it might be. And I think these people, whether it's Roger Daltrey or when I did the teenage cancer stuff, I'd done that for 20 years, you meet all sorts of different people in this industry. And at the end of the day, you're learning something from everybody. You know, that's one thing my old man told me when I was a kid, you can always learn from somebody and you can always learn from somebody what not to do as well. Mm. It's the two things. It's not always about stealing something. It's like, well, I wouldn't do that. You know, there's a lot of things you can take.
It's about being present, isn't it? It feels like Tom Jones is the kind of guy who is present. Yes. So when he's with you, you get all of him.
Yes.
He's not thinking about tomorrow or sending a text message or he's there. So he that's when you get those moments together.
That's absolutely
when you
what it is, yeah. And I think most people are guilty of that. It's very, very few people you find who are able to do
that.
You
have to work hard.
You do have to work harder.
Be present.
Yeah. But I don't think he does. I think he is naturally in that place, you know.
Are you naturally in that place?
No, I'm not.
It's a really good, I mean, John Wilkinson on the podcast you listened to, Vaz, where he spoke about all of me in every moment was his phrase, which I think is, I've used that so often in my own head.
I think I've lost years.
Do you?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I've lost years worrying and not being present in the room and my head has took me down so many wormholes in my life that I've lost so much time from doing it. And that's one thing I'd in the future I'd never want to continue to do. It's an occupational hazard in some ways because the places you go to brings out some gold sometimes. But unfortunately, you can miss moments in your life that are right in front of you.
I wonder whether you have to go there, though, to do what you've done. Like, a lot of worry, like I always, my wife worries a lot, and I always say to her, it's your brain playing a trick.
Yeah.
But in some ways, you have to let your brain play tricks on you and do some crazy stuff because that's where you're... Yeah. A little bit of magic.
Is
it going to be the worry trick or is it going to be the magic trick? You only find out when you open the door, right?
It's true. And, you know, if I've gone to see people about it over the years, you know, it's like, well, if, you know, I'm never going to be a guy that's going to take medication to level off whatever I'm feeling, this, that, and the other, because, you know, what I do is that's what it is. It's that kind of thing. But you're absolutely right. It's going forward. It doesn't mean you can't get gold from being present either, you know, because you're seeing more. So it's a new episode for me, for sure. And I'm making new boundaries in my life and trying to do new things and different things because I think it's standing up to the fear, really, and the vulnerability of it all and trying to make it like, well, challenge it in a different way.
Brilliant. It's been so nice to sit and chat for the last hour. Therapy, are you an advocate?
I am. Yeah. I've used it on and off in my life. I've had a lot of stuff going on in my life at different times. And like I said, I'm using it now as well with what Colby's going through. So I think it works for different people. Some people don't get off on it, but I think if it can help you through certain times, then yeah, some people can't talk and some people find it better writing stuff down or whatever, you know, but I feel it's worked for me because I think I can articulate and express stuff and get something back from it. But yeah.
And it doesn't have to be a formal 50 quid an hour therapy. Sometimes just a conversation like this.
Exactly.
About
I mean,
approach to life is.
I mean, every other week I'm rehearsals with the boys is like a therapy session. Every time I walk in the studio, it's a therapy session with somebody. Somebody's having some drama. It goes on forever.
Listen, we've got some quick fire questions to finish the pod with. Okay. What are your three non-negotiable behaviors that people around you have to buy into?
I don't really tolerate fools.
Mm-hmm.
Honesty.
Yeah.
And reliable.
So what advice would you give a teenage Kelly just starting out on his journey?
I was pretty chilled out when I was fucking there. I wouldn't mind being there now. I wouldn't really change it. I would probably say just get your head done and go for whatever it is you're after, really, because I think it's all possible. And I genuinely believe that. I think if you put your mind to it, not to sound like Back to the Future, but I think the problem most kids have is they can't find the thing that they want to do. And that's why I'm grateful now. In my instance, my oldest, Colby, has realized that the thing he wants to do is like this digital design thing. And now he's found this course in this place where he can go with like-minded kids. So it doesn't matter if he does well in maths, English, this, that, and the other. He knows what he wants to do. And so as long as he gets the things he wants to get from those subjects that can actually take him to that place, then that's one step. And I think try to do things in smaller chunk sizes, really, because I think we all tend to go looking at the massive picture and become overwhelmed. So I would take small bits at a time.
Find your passion. This can be any definition you choose. Are you happy?
Yeah, I am happy. I'm blessed in the house I've got and the family I've got. Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Good.
So how important is legacy to you?
I think it used to be a lot more important to me, legacy, because, you know, when you're younger, you've got this, not an ego, like you've got an ego, but there's a part of you that thinks, there's a moment in life you think, who's going to play me in a film? And then you realise, well, nobody's going to make a film about you, mate. You know.
Hold on, one's just been released.
Yeah, but I mean it.
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean. So legacy, I guess, for me has always been a catalogue of stuff that will stand the test of time, really, as long as the work I do still holds true years to come.
And finally, for those people listening to this, what would you say is your one golden rule to living a high-performance life? The one final message you'd like to leave people with?
Don't take it too seriously. Yeah.
From a man who probably has at times, yes, over the years.
Yeah. Don't take it too seriously, yeah.
Listen, thanks so much for sitting down and chatting with us. The film, Don't Let the Devil Take Another Day, thanks, is for anyone that wants to find out even more about you. It's well worth watching. It's an amazingly moving film, totally honest. And, you know, I think that when we sit here and have a conversation, whether it's those early days when you set the band up and you got rejection after rejection after, yeah, rejection, or when you had 5 number one albums on the spin, then you released an album that went to number 11 in the charts. And I know at the time the label went, oh, well, you're done now. You can just write songs for other people. Or,
that's right, yeah.
You know, losing a bandmate, or your son coming out as trans. There's always things that you've had to deal with over the years. And I think at times we can get obsessed with the fact that this is something that I can't cope with. And it's only on reflection that you realize all the brilliant stuff that's happened to you is because of those moments.
It is. I mean, 2019 was unbelievable, man. It was Colby telling me he wanted to be a boy. I had throat surgery. We had, I was just about to play Latitude. Jackie had a miscarriage with twins. It was so much going on in one period of time, all happening. And it's not till you watch that film back, you actually realize, you know, what was going on behind the eyes, really. It's quite alarming what people can go through, you know? But yeah, it is those things that get you out the other side. Like I said, I probably wouldn't be talking the way I'm talking if I hadn't gone through it. Unfortunately, you have to go through it, don't you?
Sure. But as a viewer, Kelly, I'd say that I came out with an enhanced level of respect for you, that not only were you a survivor, but you came with dignity as well. So thank you for sharing it.
Thank you very much, man. Appreciate that.
Damien.
Jake.
You know that feeling when you get someone and you just sense it's the right time to have a conversation?
Very much, yeah. I think he was open, he was candid, and he was incredibly honest.
And part of me, while the interview was going on, I was thinking, hold on a minute, we're talking about struggle and strife and learnings and difficulties and expressing yourself. Like, we're talking to a guy who has sold millions and millions of albums around the world. He's been in one of the most successful British music bands that I can ever remember. Like, why didn't we talk more about the highs and the successes? But I just think it's so important to remind ourselves and our listeners that, a bit like the iceberg analogy we used, sometimes you look at someone and you see the tip and think, wow, what a great and easy life that is. But everyone is having these struggles.
Absolutely. And I think that's more useful for people to hear, that, you know, his story about growing up in a small town and having just the passion to go and learn his craft, learn the technique of being a musician, is valuable for anyone to hear it. You know, taking your friends on the road and eventually having to decide that people won't always come with you on that journey. You know, we've used the phrase before, seasons, reasons, and lifetimes that people are with us for. I think they're all valuable tools for any of us, whatever endeavor that we're focused on achieving high performance in.
And I think you can trace back everything he's done to the roots that he was given in that little Welsh village all those years ago, can't you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think the example of his father going off and pursuing it himself, and him taking it then to the next level, you know, his friendship with Stuart that was 6 doors down from him, the just that discipline of the boxing club that he spoke about at 10 or 11 years old. There's so many threads there that are still running through his life today.
And when you can tell your kids a story about what David Bowie told you when you were sharing a stage before you went and had a chat with Bono before appearing in Live 8, you know that's a life lived.
Yeah, that's a fairly, in a game of top trumps as a parent, I think he wins that one.
Definitely. Thanks, mate.
Brilliant, thank you.
Damien, I really enjoyed that conversation with Kelly. And as always, you and I, we get sent a kind of little preview copy to have a listen to. And I did the school run a couple of days ago, and the preview episode dropped into my inbox. You know, have a listen to this, see what you think. And a few minutes in, Harriet was crying listening to Kelly talking about
about fear, about sacrifice, but also about parenting. And it was a moving episode, wasn't it? And not the sort of thing that I think you would have heard from Kelly before.
No, I think what really struck me about it, Jake, was how vulnerable he was and how he embraced that. I know that was a phrase that we used a lot in our interview, but, you know, like from the outside in, you see these rock gods like Kelly, that they look like they're swaggering, they're uber confident, they've got an answer for everything. And I think he came in and he was humble, he was quiet, and he was prepared to listen. And I felt that when we asked him a question, he gave us eye contact, and there was an intensity to him that made me really warm to him.
Yeah, and I hope for you listening to that at home, it's just another reminder that, and we spoke, didn't we, in the podcast about this iceberg effect where you see the little bit on the surface and there's so much going on below the surface. I just hope it's a reminder for you at home that there is so much more going on in the minds of people who from the outside seem untroubled and thoroughly successful, but even they're struggling.
Yeah, there's a lovely quote in there. I think it's attributed to different people, but it's like, be kind, because everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. And I think that's a good reminder that in terms of Kelly's message is that we should be kind, because he's got his own battles, he's got his own troubles, whether it was that threat of losing his voice or whether it's some of his family issues that they're working through, that I think that kindness is always a superpower.
As is a cuddle, as Kelly told us. Loads of comments this week. Here's one for you. You need to get on the phone, I think, because Ian said, your mission, if you choose to accept it, Jake and Damien, is to put Johnny Wilkinson and Matthew McConaughey in the same room for a future high-performance podcast would be even more mind-blowing than the two individual episodes. This tweet will not self-destruct after 5 seconds. I like that one.
Well, I like the idea of getting people together. I think we've spoken about that, haven't we, about getting the maybe previous rivals that in a room and sharing different perspectives on each other. And I think that flexibility of seeing the world from a different lens is something that really intrigues us.
Actually, rivals, but also people who kind of lifted each other up. You know, people who were in the same field, the same dressing room, the same boardroom, and were kind of carried along by each other. And I'll tell you what, actually, if you're listening to this, just send us a message, if you wouldn't mind. Either leave it where you leave the reviews on where you get your podcasts, or get in touch with us on social media, High Performance on Instagram, Damien's at Liquid Thinker. Maybe just let us know who you would like us to speak to for a kind of head-to-head double guest high performance podcast. Another one here from Instagram, and this is from an inspired new listener. Hi, I just want to say, wow, I've just discovered the High Performance Podcast and I absolutely love it. I've just started flicking through and picking pods at random. They're so interesting, inspiring and informative, and the range of guests from Ant Middleton, Sir Clive Woodward through to Lily Cole is amazing. So keep up the good work, guys. Thank you so much. And there was another one, Damien, and this is from George Kirkpatrick, and I shouted this out on my social media, he says, securing great guests will attract listeners. Asking great questions will keep them. Continuously impressed by the thoughtfulness and candidness of the questions asked and the meticulous exploration of often complex topics. Jake and Damien are clearly proactive in their preparation, but equally commendably reactive in how they listen and direct the conversations and respond to what guests are actually saying. Truly inspirational, obsessed. I mean, what an amazing comment from George. I think the first thing is to say to you, George, and everyone else, we go through the ratings and the reviews on the podcast providers. We see them, they give us energy, we react to them, so please keep them coming. I think the other thing, right, Damien, is if you take something really good and put it on, I don't know, BBC One or NBC at 7 o'clock in the evening, like, you will get lots of people watching because it's on a mainstream channel at a mainstream time. When you create something like the High Performance Podcast, people have to actively go and find it. And I think that's why I'm so touched when we get the listener numbers that we're enjoying.
Yeah, definitely. I think that one of the key phrases that we've spoken about in high performance is about choice. You know, high performers don't find themselves there by accident. They've made a very deliberate choice to commit to going after whatever their targets or their ambitions are. And I think that applies to anybody that's good enough and kind enough to come along with us on this journey. They're making a choice that they want to understand the principles of high performance, and then the choice is how they choose to listen, engage and relate to their own lives. So it comes back to that key word about people choosing to do this. And I know I speak for both of us and the whole of the high performance team that we're grateful when people make that choice to accompany us.
We actually really enjoy the fact that we're having an impact. You know, I know that for some people, they get the High Performance Podcast on and they listen to it and it makes them feel good or a bit emotional or it feeds their soul in some way. And that's lovely as well. But when people get in touch and say, we are actively changing the way that they work, or there's a guy that got in touch to say he was doing a charity walk and the podcast accompanied him and inspired him on every single step of that attempt to raise money. Those real world impacts of the pod are like, wow, that's everything.
Well, again, it comes back to that phrase that we've used before, Jay, that we're not doing this for the income, we're doing it for the outcome. And the outcome for both of us is that we want to try and make a positive difference to people and their lives. And if people are finding some of this content useful, that is a real validation for both of us that gives us a huge buzz. So, yeah, thank you for anyone that shares that.
I know that because we can't be together with COVID and everything, we're recording these wrap-ups and stuff over video call, Damien. So you're at home, so am I. Have you got any books near you? Because Timmy on Insta has said, I wondered if you guys would be up for just giving me a quick book recommendation. Thanks very much. Keep up the good work. The podcast is changing people's mindsets. And I'll start. I just bought this actually a couple of days ago. And Sunil, who's the CEO at Whisper, our production company, I've sent him a copy as well for Christmas. And it is No Rules Rules by Reed Hastings and Erin Meyer. Reed Hastings, of course, was the Netflix co-founder and the CEO. And effectively, it's the first book that they've done. And it's interviews with Netflix employees around the globe. And it's stories from their career creating Netflix and being disruptive and thinking without boundaries and thinking outside the box and not taking the status quo as the way things have to be. And that is No Rules Rules. It's going to be my motto for 2021. I'm going to try and think without those boundaries.
Brilliant. And it's exciting to think about how Sunil and the rest of the team at Whisper are going to take it and apply it as well.
Yeah, we'll see.
I've got this book, The Passion Paradox, that I'm reading at the minute by a guy called Brad Stolberg and Steve Magnus. They wrote a really good book about peak performance. And this is just, the phrase is, it's a guide of going all in. That Stephen Gerrard phrase of finding success and discovering the benefits of an unbalanced life. And it's just about how you harness a passion for something and then make it work for you. So that's a book I'd definitely recommend.
And it reminds me of a phrase I'll leave you with. Hard work without passion is just hard work. Passion without hard work is just passion. You've got to have one, you've got to have the other as well. And finally, Kevin Graham. We haven't got time to play it here, but Kevin left us a video message on Twitter. And he loved the conversation with Matthew McConaughey so much. He was inspired to leave us a message, and we love seeing that sort of stuff. So thank you very much, Kevin, and everyone else that's got in touch with us this week. Another interesting episode, Damien.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, a real privilege to record it, and hopefully people get equal satisfaction from listening.
Absolutely. Damien, as always, huge thanks to you. Thank you very much to Will and Hannah for their hard work on the podcast, to Finn Ryan at Rethink Audio as well. Please do rate the pod, review the pod. It makes a huge difference to us. Find us on YouTube, type in High Performance Podcast. You can watch the interviews as well as listen to them, and just continue to talk about, to shout out the podcast, to share it with your friends, to use it for inspiration. The more you talk about it, the more other people see it, the more other people see it, the more people that listen to it, and the more we can grow this ever-expanding community. Damien, top man, thanks. Have a wonderful week.
Thanks, Jay. You too. Loved it as always.
Wonderful. I really hope you enjoyed this episode of the High Performance Podcast, and there is another one on its way very soon. Thanks a lot.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts?
Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.